Blog Talk Radio. Wake up and live. Oh, my, 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 my. Yes, what a theme for our program this evening. We must wake up and live. Daryl Clark, and yes, you are at the right place at the right time. And yes, you are at the right time. No, you've not missed any of our program this evening, as we've had a late start due to unforeseen circumstances. But I'm going to take that as a precursor for something very good, because it seems like whenever these hurdles come up, it sets the stage for an outstanding program, which I believe we have for you today. We will have our program in its entirety, so we'll have to extend the time somewhat if needed. And for those of you who received my weekly news letter email, and well, you know who our special guest is for this evening. And for those of you who are not on the mail list, you will certainly want to get on the mail list. And you'll do that by simply sending me an email at Daryl, that's D-A-R-R-Y-L, underscore C-L-A, 1-8 at msn.com. And be sure to get you added on, and you can be privy to who our guest will be for the upcoming week. So for those of you who were able to catch last week's program, well, then you know that you are in for a treat. And I'm looking forward to presenting that treat, if you will. We talked about music just at a high level, and how it influences our society, different sects of our sex. That's not S-E-X, that's S-E-C-T, sections of our society. And specifically, we're referring to the African and Latino aspects of our society. And our special guest, who were unable to make it last week, are here this week. Well, at least a part of that guest. And you'll understand what I mean very shortly. So just to pick up on what we were talking about is, it's crucially influential, music with our society. It's played a role going all the way back pre-America to the drums of Africa. It was used to signal invaders and to communicate with other areas, other tribes, through the 50s and 60s, and even prior to that, with the old Negro spirituals that some, and it's not uncommon to hear it be said that those spirituals is what got many of the African slaves through some of those trials and troubling times that we were able to endure. And then all the way up and through, as I was saying, the 50s and the 60s, when songs such as Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, were able to set the tone for a movement unlike that which has been repeated in American history. So yes, I think, and I dare say, it's undisputable the role that music does play in our society. So we're going to just, in this mini-series, and I say mini-series because this is the first that we're going to be touching upon this subject matter. Because as positive of a role as music has played, we must also acknowledge that it has played somewhat of a negative role as well. And speaking in terms of more recent times, if you look at some of the current music that has been out, and we're going to have a really good discussion about that to some degree even today, that has promoted crime and perversion. We need to be very careful who is behind this music and what's behind this music. And so today, our special guest, as you'll see, is one to endeavor in one genre of that music, which is so often misunderstood. That would be rap and hip-hop. And so our special guest is part of a duo known as Negros Americanos. And they play a form of rap hip-hop with a message. And that's not to belittle any other rap or hip-hop that's out there and to say that it has no message, because I'd be the first to point my thumb right back at me and say that's ridiculous. Do look forward to this conversation when we have some dialogue with one component of this rap hip-hop duo. And they are truly, as you'll find out, a young, highly talented, progressive urban rap duo. And their rap traverses boundaries. It crosses cultures, fuses musical influences. And what I love is it addresses issues concerning oppressed people internationally. This evening, of the duo, we have Lyle Omalayo. His partner, Bishop, is out of the country in South America. And we'll talk a little bit about that as well. So I encourage you to join in, as always, in this dialogue. And should you decide to, you'll want to press 1 on your dial, or make sure that you've dialed in to 347-838-9142. That's 347-838-9142. So without further ado, I welcome you to join us as we have this pertinent discussion. Lyle, a.k.a. MC Enigma, are you there?
Yes, sir. Hello?
I really appreciate you. Yes, can you hear me?
I'm here.
Okay. I really appreciate you taking the time out this evening and being willing to have some reflection and dialogue and share with us some of the things that you've done and are doing and are looking to do in the area of music, and how you got started and why you do what you do.
Okay.
We already have the line starting to expand here, so they've responded to the email letter that I've sent out, and I'm looking forward to some really spirited dialogue.
Yes,
so with all of that said, if you would, I've given 100,000 feet, you know, in terms of what you're about. Tell us a little bit about Negros Americanos.
Negros Americanos is the brainchild of me and Bishop, right? I'm MC Enigma, Lyle Omalayo, and Bishop Isan Abia Jordan was my brother. You know, we grew up together in Plainfield, like, since middle school. And we noticed, like...
Now, that's Plainfield,
the early
New Jersey, of course.
Plainfield, New Jersey, yeah. P-Funk, home of George Clinton. So
well, we are
a
national site, so I had to say that because there's folks from all over listening.
True indeed. We noticed there was an influx of Latinos coming in the playing field, and we knew that the racial demographic was changing, and we knew times are getting harder as far as oppression goes. You know, things are getting better for some and worse for others. And as we traveled, we used to be an Upward Bound, a Rutgers Upward Bound program that would take us on college tours and, you know, expose us to things that, you know, inner city youth just didn't get an opportunity to see. And as we traveled through the United States, going on those college tours in high school, we noticed, like, yo, it's black and Latinos in every hood in the U.S. And then you got your white trailer parks. But predominantly, you'll find blacks and Latinos suffering socioeconomically across the board. And in 2010, there had been about 50 assaults of Latinos all around the city, you know, some of which were undocumented. And if you Google poppy hunting, that's what will come up. Plainfield, New Jersey, will, because a lot of the,
how
you know, black
that?
Kids.
Poppy hunting for our
poppy,
listeners.
P-A-P-I, right, a derogatory term used to describe a Latino male, a poppy, right? This is what a lot of the young black kids would say. And poppy hunting. So if you listen to Nas from Illmatic, on his first album, he said, robbing foreigners take their wild state jewels and rip their green card. Because they're, you know, oppressed people. They're in a position where, you know, a lot can't have bank accounts if they're illegal, right? Or they're working jobs where they're getting paid cash, being picked up real early in the morning, and, you know, they work till can't see at night and getting dropped off at night. And they became easy pickings for a lot of the stick-up kids in Plainfield. So we wanted to be able to engage the Latino community, but we first had to learn the language. Right, so me and Bishop are both members of People's Organization for Progress out in Newark. We're members of the Plainfield chapter. And there was a student by the name of Spencer Cadigan who was shot and killed on Front and Clinton. And we
now,
you know,
Front
formed
and Clinton
a piece.
Is what, somewhere in the hood? Because,
okay.
Again,
yeah,
I just had
yeah,
to adjust
yeah.
to break it down because we're national. And there's folks from California,
yes,
Texas, Ohio,
yes,
New York.
So there's a notorious block in Plainfield, New Jersey, Clinton Ave, and Front Street. That corner is where Spencer got killed. And we canvassed that entire area, which is the hood on the West End. And a lot of the Spanish folks, one, we couldn't talk to them because we didn't know the language. But two, there was some distrust seeing groups of black men coming to their doors. Because that's who had been assaulting, you know, some of their family members. So when we went to talk to some folks, they would close the door, and one even called the cops on us. So we were like, yo, we've got to figure out a way to engage the Latin community, and let's first start with saying hello. So we had to learn a language. So we flew down to Panama and lived out there for a year, to learn the language, to experience something outside the United States, to be able to come back and build with Latinos, but also to connect with Africans throughout the diaspora. When you go to Panama, Panama is a black country. You know, it's tons of black and brown people there. Like, you have to kind of search for white folks, right? They're literally a minority. And when we think Panama, when we think Colombia, when we think Spanish-speaking countries, a lot of times we automatically go to that picture of the novella, you know, with the cowboys and, you know, these Jane Fonda-looking white women. But that's not what you see when you go down there. It's the novellas and Univision and Telemundo is not representative of the populations that they say they serve, right? They're a lot much darker than we see on television. So we're trying to dispel some of those myths with Negros Americanos, but also we're tiptoeing back through the diaspora. We're enslaved by the English, we learn English. Spanish, we learn Spanish. Portuguese, that's what's next. And Bishop, my partner in crime, he's in Brazil right now. You know, studying Portuguese and connecting with Brazilian artists out there. You know, and the whole Afro-Latino scene, right? He's been building with a lot of people in Brazil. One thing that's really good for us, because our group, you know, the message is positive one. It's very fun. You know, we make sure we have fun doing it. But what's, and it's very, you know, very pro-black. What's good about Brazil is they have such a huge concentration there of Yoruba, the highest concentration, actually, of Yoruba practitioners outside of Nigeria or West Africa is in Brazil and then in Cuba. And, like, a lot of the Santeras, a lot of people who practice voodoo, Kundumble, they would go to, you know, Cuba to get initiated. So the, all of this being said, we're the goal of Negros Americanos, and really the point of the whole group, is about unifying people. It's about tiptoeing through the diaspora and repairing the damage.
Wow.
It's a lot.
You know,
no,
it's not that it's a lot. It's not so much the quantity. It's the quality of what you're saying. Because, you know, in these times, there are a number of folks that don't take that position in terms of the Latino and African-American connection. And, you know, just to hear that your brother specifically keyed in on that area in and of itself is significant. And then decided to use music, you know, as a bridge to reach out. I know also that you're using music not just as a bridge to that Latino community and to bridge the Latino and the black community, but you're also using music as a means of bringing about awareness of other social issues.
Yes.
So I'm going to come back to the Latino piece. But can you talk to some of the other things that you're using music as a bridge for?
Yeah, definitely. It's a conduit, you know, of getting a message out. And I feel like when you get someone to listen to your music or your art, it's a very privileged position to be in, you know, because you have their ear and they can be listening to anything. They'd be reading anything. So I always try to make sure we give something with substance so it will not be a complete waste of time or just entertainment value, right? So we've, starting off, when I was in college, the last assignment that I had for lit and film class became the last record on my first album. It's called Islamophobia. And I interviewed a bunch of Muslims throughout Hudson County, like around 2000, I want to say six, after 9/11, about their experience. And then, you know, chronicled that and put it into a song. And because it's, you know, put in hip-hop form, easier to be digested for some folks, right? Putting or alluding to chapters in a Noam Chomsky book could probably get someone to read it, right? But if I threw the whole book at them, they'd be like, ugh, right? We have a generation of folks coming up now that they don't even like the paper books. You know, I teach. So a lot of kids, they're all in their Kindles. Everything's digitized. So it's a must to stay constant with the demographic we're trying to engage. So that's why we do it through hip-hop form. Born and raised in it, but also it is a tool. So through hip-hop, I learned about Ivan Van Sertima and John Henry Clark and Marcus Garvey through listening to hip-hop, listening to Black Star, Mos Def, Talib, Kweli, Dead Prez, The Roots, KRS-One, had a big influence and big impact on the music that we create. Those guys, Gil Scott-Heron, you know, the last poets. We even worked with Abiodun Oyewale from The Last Poets. He's on our album Take Flight on the intro. And we're just trying to carry on that tradition. So Negros Americanos definitely is not in the relay to brag about how much money we don't have or how many girlfriends we're stealing or, you know, chanting materialism. We gain nothing from that, and that's not why we're here. There are other people that do that. That's cool. That's them. That's not what we're doing at all. Right, so it is political, but it's digestible. The music is digestible. Anyone who's come to one of our performances can say, "No, you guys have fun when you do that. I had fun because you had fun." Right, so trying to break down the concepts of, you know, Khalid Muhammad and Ivan Van Sertima, but make it palatable to the listener who might not have picked up the book, but maybe can get them to down the line.
Yeah, that's it's a beautiful thing. You mentioned Bishop, your partner, is out of town.
Sir. Yes.
And he's where again?
He's in Sao Paulo, Brazil, in a neighborhood called Capo Redondo, which is in the South Zone, and was actually in the 90s one of the most dangerous cities in the world. But historically, it's also one of the most culturally rich neighborhoods in Sao Paulo and in Brazil. And the government, after all the crime and the drug cartels in the 90s, started to funnel money into arts and the creation. So that area is very booming in terms of art now, when before it was for crime. And literally a group called the Hashanice MCs that are from Sao Paulo, from that area, they survived a giant prison riot where like 300 inmates were shot dead. And then they formed a group that was, you know, speaking pro-black, the public enemy of Brazil, pretty much, you know. Mm-hmm. And it literally changed the face of the neighborhood. You know, that's a place that's to this day run by the cartels in the favela, by the gangsters. But there's more order there. It's crazy. There's more order there, from what I'm being told from people that's living down there. There's more order down there and less police brutality. As a result, gangs controlling that area rather than how we, you know, we rely on the state.
You know.
So that's where Bishop is right now. That's where he is. He's in Brazil.
So you've cut several CDs and. Mm-hmm. You have anything recent that's come out or coming out?
Yeah, so recently we just put out a documentary. It's called Lost in the Wilderness, the story of Negros Americanos, and it details our travels from Plainfield, New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey, to Panama City, Panama, to Costa Rica, and you know we introduce a lot of new faces down there, and people that we've interacted with, because when you leave the United States and you go into, you know, say, a Panama, you know, we had all these ideas about how we'll be perceived as Americans, as black people, as young folks, as hip-hoppers, and a lot of that stuff got crushed. And we talked about it in the doc, and one of the big things that stood out, like, crazily, was how overt the racism is, but how covert conversation about it is. There's a saying in Panama called Mejor la raza, right, which means better the race. And that's being said by black folks, right, predominantly grandmothers telling their granddaughter, better the race, better the race. And that translates into go get you a white man, have lighter babies. Mejor la raza, limpio tu sangre, clean your blood. Get you a European man, have the seed, and then the baby will come out lighter. Right? So that was a nuance that we were like, huh, interesting. So, like, for the most part, in America, the black woman, for the most part, still wants a black man. Still wants a black man. Still riding, even though we're giving them hell, still wants a black man. In Panama, black man's been abandoned. If you see a black woman in the States that, you know, dating interracially, you see they're equally yoked. You see that guy from, what was it, Subway commercial? Jared, who had the fat pants?
Yeah.
You know, you'll see those types of white guys, like Egon from Ghostbusters, you know, Poindexter-looking dudes. And those are they're pulling the Gabrielle Union-looking type black women in Panama, you know, because it's all about a mentality. You know, Latin America, as far as racial identity, there's a lot of pain and damage there. They had a guy named Trujillo in the DR. If they speak French, kill him, he said. Trying to get rid of the Haitians. All these things have a major impact on how Latinos view themselves. You'll get a jet black Latino. I almost got in a fight with a guy in Staten Island. He looked at my shirt. It said, Negros Americanos. He said, why negro? Negro fail. Right, negro's ugly. But he was dark. He was Wesley Snipes dark, you know? And I said, bro, I'm black like you. I'm not black. I'm Spanish. And I mean, I'm not black, I'm English, right? Right? You're going by that logic. So there's a lot of misconceptions, and I feel like for us to start having these conversations with different groups of melanated folks, we got to first speak their language, learn a thing or two about them, right? The way we form Negro Semitic. Yes, sir.
Well, one thing that I've just heard is a lot of what's happening with regard to race is not just from an American's perspective. And I think more and more African-based Americans need to understand that, but it's global, as you were just saying. This plight that is going on is no longer just national; it's international, and we need to get engaged. And because the world is so much smaller now, so to speak, with all the technology and more access for more people. I believe it's just critically important that people come together to have, as you say, a dialogue, a real dialogue. And you were going to say the way you formed Negros, I believe. But before you go with that, I just want to mention to our listeners that number, if you care to participate in this dialogue or ask a question of Brother Lyle, a.k.a. MC Enigma, you'll want to press 1 on your phone, and myself or our engineer will pick up and put you in queue if you'd like to have participation in this dialogue. The number is 347-838-9142, in case you haven't dialed that. And if you have, just press 1, and we'll see your hand on the board. And make sure that you get a chance to engage in the conversation. So continue. The way that you were formed, I believe you, I didn't mean to interrupt you for the sake of interrupting.
Yeah, we you know, Bishop came to me in 2009 and was like, yo, I got the idea for this rap group. We're going to be like the Fugees, you know, we're going to be international, we're going to do all these different languages. I'm like, okay, how are we going to do this? It's like, yo, our original idea was to create a collective that's a diasporic collective. So where you can get all walks of the diaspora inside that group. And like communication-wise, you know, when we look at colonization in, you know, in this hemisphere, we're dealing with the Portuguese, we're dealing with the French, the English, we're dealing with the Spaniards, those four. So if we want to talk to melanated people in this side of the world, and actually that side too, a lot of Africa, you know, once we get Dutch and a couple other languages, that could cover the continent as far as places that were colonized. Trying to tiptoe back through that. So he came to me in about 2009. I was like, yo, I got this idea for the group. But we chose Panama because we originally were going to go to Chiapas, Mexico, because we were studying the Zapatista uprising and had some connects down there in Mexico that were going to show us some things. But we ended up going to Panama because we wouldn't stand out as much, right? So it would be easier for us to move around undetected, keep a low profile. Still, it was high profile, but we chose Panama because there was already a great number of Americans that were retiring there. So you had a large group of expats. And then also, because of the culture, it was a very black country. But a lot going on with that canal, too, and in that zone. So that's where we started. And we didn't just come out to Panama like, yo, we're Negros, and that's it. Now, we didn't become Negros Americanos until August. We stayed from January to August learning Panama, learning the language, learning the culture, learning the layout, right, learning the system and how it works. And we met a guy named Pocho in Ciudad Radial, which was one of the neighborhoods we lived in. And when he joined the group, that's when Negros Americanos became real. When it was three of us, we had one Panamanian and then two brothers from Jersey. But because of touring, because of, you know, commitments and things, that fell off. It stayed me and Bishop. And we're still cool with those people, but that's the nucleus of the group. And it's like, okay, we're going to learn these languages and we're going to continue to move with a positive message, one that can connect with folks down there. Because when we, the type of hip-hop we do, too, is respected in other parts of the world. Like, you alluded to hip-hop or kind of music, right, that sometimes is destructive. Yes, very, very influential. In America, they figured it out. You know, in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, when hip-hop started making a whole lot of money, early 90s, really, when they saw Fight the Power by Public Enemy, that song, when it dropped, created a riot. Like, they had a riot at their video shoot. A bunch of politically charged young black people with an enhanced sense of self-pride. There's this thing called the Kerner Commission, right, that reports on different happenings in the U.S. And when they had the riots in L.A., the Kerner Commission report said that those people who are rioting more were the kids who were listening to hip-hop and who had an enhanced sense of racial pride. I'm pretty sure that had something to do with the movie Malcolm X coming out, Spike Lee being big in the early 90s, but also groups like Public Enemy and NWA that, like, stood up to police brutality overtly and made it trendy. They said, we're not gonna have this again. So the industry in the American market is very narrow. It shows a monolith of blackness, which is ratchet, which is, you know, misogynist, hedonist, self-destructive. Outside of this market, though, when I was in Panama, there were B-boys, there were B-girls. They were playing KRS-One down there. They played this guy, John Robinson, big fan of him. And I'm like, yo, y'all know John in Panama? Yeah. So there are markets outside of the U.S. market. I mean, look at who our president is going to be. That's indicative of what's in this country, right, for what the mentality is. There are other places on this earth that are more receptive. And I say, honestly, here, people, if they knew more about the different types of art that was being suppressed intentionally, they'd be into it. You don't know the gourmet cookies are there. They never offered them. They're in the back somewhere. You got to dig for it.
You know, I heard you say when, for example, Public Enemy came out, Fight the Power, they were like, okay, we can't do this. And you mentioned, was it, which commission was it? Because there's a lot of
things
out there.
They called it the Kerner Commission report. A Kerner Commission.
Is that like K-E-R-N-E-R or C-E?
You know what? Let me see. Let me look it up real quick.
Okay, but in the meantime,
It's a National Advisory Commission, so K-E-R-N-E-R, Kerner Commission, because they were going over what happened as far as civil disobedience in the black community, what got these young kids to rebel? You know, and it was them being politically oriented by the music. You know, I listening to Wu-Tang Clan, that's what I learned. Honestly, I saw Malcolm X when I was little and even read autobiography, but later, it became cool when I found out Ghostface Killer was rapping about him. When I heard Mos Def say, "I do it for John Henry Clark and Ron Brown, Freedom Fighters going down." I'm like, Ron Brown? I, in middle school, went to the Ron Brown School of Global Issues. Wait, Ron Brown was killed. They said he died in a plane crash, but he had government-issued bullets in his head. He was Secretary of Commerce for Clinton. Right? So in middle school, I knew something was up. And then hearing it in rap records of black men that I revered, oh, man. So It's like, yeah.
That's that link that you're talking about, the intellectual link. We're going to come back to the other side of that, the side that, well, potentially could be destructive for our youth because of the imagery. I can't remember which Black Awards program it was, but I saw little Kim literally cock her legs open like a $10 hole, and it was pretty disgusting. And I don't think that, you know, I don't think that's the image, because we're trying to raise princes and princesses to grow into kings and queens. And that's not, I think, something that is going to facilitate that. So there's some imagery going on within that genre that I think needs to be clearly segregated from some of the artists that you're talking about, Mos Def and Wu-Tang and some of the others. But I want to go to our listeners because I know they're, like I said, the lines are blowing up, so it's obviously something that's stirring energy, and it's something that I think has been under the radar too long in terms of the potential of music to play a role, because right now those of African descent and Latino are in dire straits from what I have seen and studied. So I want to first go to, we have a listener out of New York, and we have a listener, looks like locally here in New Jersey. So we're going to go to our listener in New York and see who we have. It's a familiar number. I'm not sure if it's one of our regular listeners. You're on the air, 708-718-338. Would you have a comment about the topic of tonight?
Yes.
I know
this voice.
Yes, thanks
for calling.
Oh,
this
my God.
Ronald,
yeah, this is one of our, guests. Yes,
yes.
How are you, Ron? Ron, you've been on many times, and as a special guest, a historian in another your own right, truly a freedom fighter. So thank you for listening in. Yeah.
I want to say I bow to the gentleman that has been speaking. I mean, he's very enlightened. I appreciate hearing what he's saying. I can only, you know, comment in a way that I haven't been able to do, you know, learn people's language other than my own to kind of fellowship with them. You know, I think that's beautiful. I just want to add that all of the race thing comes out of the political economy of capitalism, because it is capitalism which is the thing that is really detrimental to humankind. Okay. It's really a form that it's a class thing. There are people at the top, and the working class is all oppressed. But the way, the method that they have of dealing with people at the bottom is to segment them, give one group, or should we say white working class, more privileges than they give black or Latinos. That's on purpose, And I think this is what I think that could help us more, is to realize that we're fixed in something that really is not built on race, but built on oppression. And the way to keep the oppression going is to have the working class divided and have, you know, hostility between white and black, so that they never realize who the conqueror is. Because, see, capitalism is an economic system, but it's not really white. See, it's something that is human, that has been adopted, and therefore, since the people on top have all of the ownership of property and production, they are the ones that try to keep the working class oppressed. And I think we have to wake up to the fact that there's only one species of humans living on the planet Earth. Just one species. Now, it has different phenotypes, just like various other animals have different phenotypes. You know, especially dogs. I mean, dogs look very different in type, and, you know, how they look to each other. I mean, greyhounds is nothing like not very similar to a St. Bernard, or should I say Doberman Pinscher. But these are all dogs, and we can see that because they all bark. But a wolf will never bark. See, he may look somewhat like a dog, but he never barks. See, so we know that that's a separate species of the canine family. You see, so I think that's something to be interjected, and I think a good book source is this book by Timothy Allen that is called The Invention of the White Race. There he puts down an analysis of how the black and white working class were treated in this country for the benefit of keeping them separated, and that, you know, called segregation, that sort of thing. So I really praise this gentleman. He's outstanding to me, and I want to just say, I more power to you. I mean, you're in there, and I wish I could do what you're doing. So I don't want to seem like I'm separating. No, I'm trying to add, but I think it's wonderful what you're doing. I have the utmost respect and regard for you.
Ron, thank you for your comments. I understand you have my sentiments in terms of wish you could do what he's doing. He's an artistic gentleman. However, I'm sure if he ever listened, and I hope he will, when you'll be joining us again to enlighten us on some of the research that you've done as a research journalist, that he'd be equally impressed. So we all have our gifts. Mm. And, Ron, we appreciate you for calling in. Yeah, Brother Enigma, Mr. Crenshaw is a frequent guest. Yeah. Well, let's go to our next listener. Thank you. And Mr. Crenshaw, we need to talk again, because you're about due to come back and share with us some nuggets of wisdom, as you do from time to time on our program. Thank you for tuning in. I truly appreciate it. What an honor to have you listening. What an honor to have you listening.
Honor to have you to put me on the air. That's what I appreciate.
Well, that's what we're about here, keeping it real and keeping it live. We're going to go to our next listener.
Sure.
And that would be locally here. Let's see if we can bring in. We have a 732-522. It's another local number. You're on the air. Would you have a comment?
Hello, Dallas Burnell.
All right, that's what I thought the number. How are you this evening? Another one of our previous guests, very active in the community. right even here locally. So you probably are very familiar with MC Enigma, our own brother Omalayo. What do you have to contribute? Yes.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with the brother. I mean, you know, just when I first met him and Jordan, a sense of pride, you know, I was just proud. I was just proud of the brothers and just in awe of them at the same time. I mean, to do what they did and to be brave enough, you know, some of us, you know, in small inner cities rarely move out of the town or go shopping outside of the town that we live in. And for these brothers to pack up and take on this journey and to go all the way out to Panama and other places, it says a lot about spirit that they have inside of them, you know. And I was just found myself very proud of them. And I kept close with them since then. And we both work in education as well, so we see each other a lot. So I just wanted to let them know that I'm very proud of them, and I it's just an honor to call them my young brothers, you know. And I first got introduced to Panama culture in 1993, when I was doing a lot of work, and I would work with, you know, I was a foreman at a painting company, and we had a lot of Hispanic employers, and you know, they used to listen to a lot of songs, and there was this one song that really, it was like a catchy little song, and it went like, no, no, tres, tres, ma, no, ni, ni, tres, ya, si tu quieres, hay otra, a mí me quieres para, and it was, it was the Henelau, and I started listening to his music and getting into him back in 93, and that's when he told me he was from Panama and everything like that, and he was very respected in the Hispanic culture, because that was on La Mega, which is dominated by Dominican singers and Puerto Rican, you know, and so he was very, and that was like the birth of reggaeton.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I remember when that came out, because he was like one of the first I ever heard. I never heard anything like that.
Wow.
And but getting back to the topic at hand, you know, back in 89, you know, I watched rap music. Daryl, you might have, I don't know how much you were into rap when it first came out, because you were like a little older. When it came, you know, you would like
Sugar Hill Gang. You know, I remember rap when it was birthed, and
yeah,
so as it began to morph, I'm old school. You know, I'm R&B. You know, funk. To be frank with you, jazz, and rap. I embraced it when it first came out. I loved the genre, but then I saw, because I've always been one to be tuned in, you know, going all the way back to when I was post high school, this is not a new journey for me, being one to be engaged in social activism. I go all the way back to being the president of my Black Student Congress at Ohio University when I was, you know, raising Cane and bringing, you know, Gil Scott-Heron was down, and I got to meet him and sit down, and I was the president that brought him down through my organization. So I go all the way back. You know, and so I was very perceptive of this thing when rap came in. I embraced it, but what I didn't like is how it squeezed out other genres. And so what I don't like to see is when they, being those who are in control, and you know what Prince did, he stepped back and said, whoa, and you see what happened there. You see what Michael did when he stepped back and said, whoa, you're trying to control my music, and you see what they did to him. I saw all of that in the works. So what my issue is people being used as pawns in that genre as they began to infiltrate and squeeze out other forms of music. And that's where I had a problem, because that was done by the powers that be. And we had some small labels trying to do some things. But what bothered me is when the folks did begin to make the money, and I don't like keep using their names, but they're the, you know, the money makers, you know, Snoop, Puffy, Jay-Z, you know, when the guys made the money to make a difference, I didn't see them going back and say, hey, we got to bring our brothers back up in here. They sampled it, but
yeah.
I didn't see any attempts to really bring some of that Regina Bell talent, you know, some of that Chaka talent. I didn't see that. It went to this little Kim kind of talent, and that's okay because, you know, we had Rick back in the day. That's, you know, hey, I'm in love with Mary Jane. That was like, oh, no, taboo. They wanted to outlaw that. So
mm-hmm.
I'm okay with having a mix, but it became so imbalanced that I realized it was part of the overall regime to control the music, to take something that could have been positive, like you said, Public Enemy, and just skew that whole thing to say, we're going to have them sagging, we only going to promote certain things on the radio, and we're going to only push certain types of rap to the point where it's going to be used against them. And that's what I saw with it. So to answer, you know, you interjected me, but I wanted to give you a quick splattering, my brother, as to where I was with it. So go ahead, Burnell.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, because I'm always interested on different age groups, what were their perception of rap, how they, because
mm-hmm.
Because not everybody who was older accepted rap. You know, some people in their 20s and 30s were into other genres of music where they didn't like rap when it came out. They just didn't accept it, you know. So I just was wondering. But just getting back into that, I mean, I remember just growing up, and like I spoke last week, rap music is responsible for my vocabulary. Some of the biggest words that I know today, you know, I learned from rap music, you know. Like,
mm-hmm.
like the, you know, the rappers back in my day, you know, I was born in 74, so I was 5 years old when rap started. And at five, that's what, you know, you're rapping every word of the song. Just look at kids on YouTube now, 5 years old. They're singing all this crazy stuff. So, but back in my day, it was important not to sell out, not to sell our culture out. I mean, Lyle, you might be a little too young to, you know, like you witnessed it, but growing up in the 70s and 80s,
sure.
We saw that it was important not to sell out. And if you sold out, you were putting that MC Hammer, that Ski-Lo and those other rappers, and you were like, you fizzed out fast, you know, you couldn't sustain a foundational base of listeners with that, you know, with that type of music that appealed to the wider audience. You know, it was so important, you know, that we kept it to ourselves, and if you wanted to hear it, you had to come to us. We weren't going to you. We weren't making music for you. We made music for us, and if you liked it and bought it, cool. And that was the days when rappers weren't concerned with going platinum, you know. They were concerned with being lyrically, you know, it was more important to be known as the best lyricist than platinum, you know. So making a segue to today's time, you know, you look at the rappers that's out today, excluding J. Cole, Kendrick Lamar, you know, looking at the rappers that are out now, the biggest rappers, what are the big vocabulary words these children are learning? You know, matter of fact, they're not learning big vocabulary words. They're learning words that's taking them, you know, they're learning words that's not in the vocabulary. That's not even in the...
Not even words.
You know, they're regressing in their vocabulary. They're mumbling, you know,
yeah.
Mumbling, and I don't want to do it, and they're talking like that where, you know, and so, you know, hip-hop music is just taking a downward turn now. In 1989, the number one rap song, it went for 10 weeks as number one on the rap charts. Do anybody want to take a guess what it was?
The number one this year?
No.
In
89.
Oh, 89 was what? Fight the Power, maybe?
Nope. Self-Destruction.
Okay, there we go.
Okay, yes.
And I think Fight the Power had 4 weeks, number one. But Self-Destruction had 10 weeks Now, this was a collaboration of the best artists at the time, and they got together, and they saw what was coming. They saw what was going on with the gang violence and things like that, and they got together, and they made this record, and it became the number, like, it became the number one record 10 weeks in a row. That's hard to do. So that was the mentality that we had. We were pushing that message that love your brother, you know, things like that, you know. And so now, you know, number one song, you know, 10 weeks in a row is going to be something negative. Now you have to ask yourself this. Besides Kendrick Lamar and J. Cole, what popular rappers right now can you put together to make a Self-Destruction Part 2? You know, without being hypocritical.
Yeah, you can't.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just those two guys. That's it. But to piggyback, I would say with Jay-Z, he has put out a lot of mess, you know, but he's put out a lot of good stuff too. And if we look at legacy, like what is he leaving behind? We got J. Cole now, thanks to Jay-Z. On a major, you know what I'm saying? He's getting the same type of burn, or at least exposure, on the same level, or the same label, let's say, as a Rihanna. And that's humongous, because J. Cole's getting exposure. Talib Kweli's not even getting, you know, by virtue of, you know, Jay-Z, Roc Nation. So I think that's one positive. You know, and then also he signed Jay Electronica, who's Fruit of Islam, so we get that information. But again, those messages aren't in the mainstream. It's not super popular. And if we were to do a Self-Destruction today, it would be a bunch of empty seats there. It would be a couple guys rapping.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, but I think Jay-Z, his negative is like 80% to a 20% positive.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember with Kumo D and Melly Mel and rappers like that, they came out, there's an actual rating system on how to rate, you know, an MC. And the rating system was based on some key pillars of hip hop, which was like, you had to be someone who was conscious, you know, like being conscious and talking about the conditions and raising the awareness of your listener gave you more points. Because, you know, in order to be the best hip hop artist, you have to do what hip hop was designed to do, right? The other thing was, you know, lyrical content, right? Now, based on your negative lyrics, and if you influenced the black culture in a negative way, that took points away from you. So,
negative way, okay.
Yeah. So like somebody like Jay-Z, like he would drop because of the negative things that he's done to our culture, you know. And you know, I remember Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre had a video. I don't remember what it was, but I remember there was a female who came into the party and she was acting all bougie, and they threw like their drink on her, and she was wet. And she walked out the club. Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Now, that was the first time that I saw a black woman being disrespected like that on a video, right?
Mm.
Then Jay-Z took it to a different level. In his, now, that was a planned scene. Like it was like, okay, who wants to play this part? Okay, basically, you're going to come in the club, you're going to react like this, and we're going to throw some drinks on you. And she signed up for it, right? But what Jay-Z and Damon Dash were doing, they were having these videos. They would get their women to do the video. They would get their hair done, put on their outfit, and while they're on a nice cruise ship or in the club, Jay-Z and Damon Dash would just grab bottles of champagne and just dump it on their head, and the female would be looking like in shock and like, oh my God, what are you doing? Like, you can see she's obviously like appalled at what's happening.
Yeah.
And that became their signature move when it came to degrading women. I just said, wow, I really hated Jay-Z for that. You know, not him, but that action. And
yeah.
I just didn't like that action. And it caused a, you know, then when I'm in the club, I saw a guy arguing with a female. Next thing you know, he's pouring a drink on her head. And so things like that, I really take Jay-Z down a couple notches because of some of the negative gangster rap, drug dealer. And I mean, even now, you know, he's with the same old thing. Jay-Z is at the point where he can really take hip hop right now and he can put it in a whole nother direction if he wanted to, you know, but he's still playing the same game, you know, of leading our children in the wrong direction. So I don't give him that respect.
Right.
Well, you know, my take on that. Go ahead, brother MC Enigma.
No, I agree everything that Bernie's saying. It's influential, you know, and we can't act like it's not. You know, just like, you know, he starts pouring bottles, then we see them start pouring bottles, and everyone starts pouring bottles. Then it becomes cool to start, you know, we're the trendsetters. Jay-Z said change clothes. I was a senior in high school when he retired, when the Black Album came out, and the first song was Change Clothes that he dropped. And I remember everybody had throwback jerseys. He said, change clothes. We're wearing button-ups now. People threw away their throwback jerseys for button-up shirts and started, you know, oh, no, we're grown men. We, you know, we're dressing up now. Imagine, you know, that level of influence, you know, and pull with the youth. Definitely could be utilized. But we'll see. And that's why we're here. You know, there's many fronts on this war, you know, many fronts, and we all play a part. Not everybody's going to be the sniper. You know, we got field medics. We got everybody. And I think that's why we're here. That's why this discussion exists. But,
you
like,
know what?
Definitely, they've been we need to hold people accountable. That definitely needs to happen. In our community as well as we're going to talk about Charlie. Mr. Charlie the man, we got to talk about Raheem and our own people as well.
Yeah. In fact, that's a great note to segue to our next episode in the series, because we will be continuing with this dialogue. I just think it's critically important. I think it's right before us, but under the radar. It's like the Roach Motel, and there are think tanks, and you're right on point when you talked about the commission. There's quite a few commissions. You can just Google commissions, think tank commissions, and you'll get a whole slew of them that are clearly designed to undermine the African American and Latino race. You know, as this world gets smaller, you know, our society is clearly going to be. Is going to be formed into segments, and African American and Latino community, as Brother Ron Crenshaw, our resident historian, was saying, is going to be crucial. The alignments that we have in order to survive, to just survive, because you look at as you say, our current president. You know, he's a class and caste kind of dude. And alliances are going to be critical. And I think one thing that we really, really need to focus on is holding ourselves accountable as much or actually more than holding those outside of our community accountable. Because the worst thing you want is a Judas, you know, the Trojan horse story. I mean, that's the worst, that's the easiest way to take a culture, a race, any sect of society down. Is to infiltrate, and I'm going to end on this note, i.e. Black Panthers. I mean, these guys were really, my brother, was a nationalist. I mean, hey, he was doing right. I know him. I'm like, I know my hand. Brother's heart was in the right place. But they villainized them, and they did it from within. So we got to be careful of those who are within our communities who are portraying to be something as a Pied Piper and leading our children. And remember, if you take the women and children, you take the race, the culture, and all other aspects of a society. And so when I think about somebody that's 80% killing our children and 20% handling a little bit of sugar, as far as I'm concerned, they're Judas, because you can't get in the camp unless you bring a little sugar. So, and all the good that they're doing, and I'm not just talking about, Jay-Z, we got to be vigilant, those of us that are in the know. And the positive, beautiful thing is love is a gazillion times more powerful. It's just that it doesn't seem like we're making any headway because of the sheer numbers. With that said, I think that as we move into further dialogue, that I want to see us be more critical of the negative aspects of various forms of music that are out there. And, whether it's hip-hop, but also understand, and I'll end on this one, that as a mentor of mine, an uncle once said, may he rest in peace, Daryl, you're going to run into a lot of negativity. It's like grass. People like, what do you do with the weeds? You get weed killer? He said, no. Yeah, I've been a farmer. And I used to look at his lawn in awe. It looked like a carpet. I used to say, how do you get your lawn, Uncle? So it's amazing. He said, Daryl, it ain't about just getting weed killer. It's about getting good grass. It'll kill out the weeds. So that's what we need, more good grass. Tree is known by the fruit it bears. Brother Enigma, keep doing the work you're doing. We need more like you to kill out the weeds. That's what this is about. That's what this is about. Bringing on the positivity. You're doing a good work. And I'm going to put you on the spot and ask that you join us in future programs. We're going to bring some brothers, and we're going to mix it up real well with some old school and some new school, and try to make a difference. All we can do is what we individually can do, and I'll certainly be here to do what I can. As we close out, I want to thank Brother Lyle Omalayo and Brother Bishop, who's here in spirit. I know he's doing the right thing down in Sao Paulo. I want to thank Brother Crenshaw for joining us, and Brother Bernie Burnell for tuning in and providing those nuggets of wisdom. Thank all the listeners, and the lines blew up, so your brothers obviously have touched upon something. We've touched upon something that people appreciate. So we're going to continue the series. Brother Omalayo, I'd like for you to come back and join us from time to time. Yeah, sure. And as we move forward, we were going to have a brother, Dr. Eddie Taylor, who was going to join us out of Chicago, who wrote the book The Day the Crabs Got Out, The Revitalization of Black America. You can Google him. He's in Barnes & Noble. It's amazing. It's his latest book. He's a black sociologist and psychologist. But he got tied up. He just reached out and texted me. He wasn't able to join us, but maybe next week or the week after. I'd like you brothers to come back and join him, because it's about us all coming together, using our old school wisdom and knowledge and our new school creativity and talent, and bringing it all together and moving in the right direction to uplift us as a nation. So with that said, Brother Enigma, MC Enigma, give us some reach-out information. How can somebody reach out and hear some more about your documentary and your website and all the other good connection information you have.
Yes. So everything, all my social media, everything is Negros Americanos. The website is Negros Americanos Worldwide. N-E-G-R-O-S, not Negroes, but Negros, Spanish spelling. Negros Americanos Worldwide.com. And the documentary is on the website. It's on YouTube. It's called Lost in the Wilderness. I'm on Facebook, MC Enigma, Lao, Negros Americanos. Everything's Negros Americanos. And the last project I put out was called Rainy Season. And Dry Season's coming. I sent you one track off of Dry Season, too. I sent you Embarrassing. And we have videos coming for it, visuals coming for it. But NegrosAmericanosWorldwide.com.
All right. Well, we're going to close on Embarrassing, how, if that's okay with you.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Let it out.
A little bit of Negros Americanos. So to our listeners, until next week when we're going to have a serious lowdown, throw down, get down, keeping it live program on Progressive News Weekly as we close out our show with Negros Americanos, Embarrassing. And tell somebody about Progressive News Weekly, where every Thursday, 6:30 to 7:30 Eastern Time, we keep it real, we keep it live. It's news for you, by you, and of you. So until then, for those up north, stay warm. For those up south, keep the fire burning. All right, peace and blessings to you all. Rough. If they ain't water properly, it's coming from nature. The philosophies of Africa and Asia, cultivated in an American plantation. My mind free, free. Your high beams can't find me. See through your evil, got the people right behind me. My face is like a barrel, yours is like a concrete door. Peace to the moors, Prince Halls and Eastern Stars. I put belief in God, the God through the deepest stars. Beyond the snake, the rat, the cat, and the dog, Mzungu, Shirungu. I took the CM, what's up going cuckoo? They tried to brainwash me, but I ain't need to. And I didn't eat their food. Yo, I cleared them all with my grapple of hooks. Reach your premises before you get a look. I'm not a crook, more looping. You see what I'm doing, will empower the poor. Lead the rich man to ruin, switch narratives. Impoverished characters share the same blood as me, but they are ravenous. Slip tax evasion, Ponzi scheme statements. For Wall Street execs and rat invested basements. Space, tear flesh, eat until nothing's left. As a paperweight to sit up on my desk, cubicle, I put the voodoo to you, to your reaches. Do not seem pleased with these false teachers, preachers, benefactors of the malady. I do not need your help when genocide comes to charity. That bullshit is embarrassing. Thank you.